The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you so much for coming to this session. This is the session entitled, Is the WTO a Development Organization? After our lunch and talk with Ms. Palacio, we sort of have to wonder what... We always knew we don't know exactly what the word development means, but maybe that's part of what we will discuss here in as part of this panel. You already have, we have a distinguished panelists here. You already have their resumes in this booklet. However, I will briefly introduce them as well. Our first speaker is Jim Baucus. Many of you who do trade may know him. He was a member of the appellate body of the WTO and its chairman, I believe, twice, right? And Jim Baucus is currently the chairman of the Global Trade Practice Group of Greenberg Traurig. He leads the firm's worldwide practice on trade policies, remedies, negotiation disputes, and other trade international trade issues. We cannot... be any more luckier to get somebody who's most intimately familiar with the WTO as an institution and the working of the dispute settlement, and specifically the appellate body. His final decision for the WTO was as the presiding judge in the appeal and the complaint by the EU, Japan, China, Brazil, and other WTO members against a safeguard measure by the United States restricting imports of steel. That decision was called by the New York Times as a rough equivalent of Marbury v. Madison in terms of the jurisprudence of the WTO, and the American Lawyer has labeled him as much as anyone to being the John Marshall of the WTO. It really is our pleasure to have him here. In his prior incarnation, Jim was actually a member of a Congress of the United States from 1991 to 1995, representing the 15 congressional districts of Florida, and his district, including much of Orlando, Walt Disney World, Cape Canaveral, and the Space Coast of Central Florida. He was elected to two terms in Congress and chose not to seek election to a third term. It's really my pleasure to introduce him to you. He needs to leave, so I do ask him to speak first, and then allow you to ask some questions of him before he needs to leave us. I will also briefly introduce our other speakers, Nicole Clark, who is an attorney and law lecturer on Cave Hill Campus, University of West Indies. Ms. Clark holds an LLB from University of West Indies and two LLM degrees, one from University of Cambridge and one from here, Washington College of Law, specializing in international law and international organization. She's a former diplomat who acted as a counselor in the permanent mission of the Barbados in the United Nations and the WTO in Geneva from 1999 to 2005. During her 6 years attached to the permanent mission, she has her principal areas of responsibility were dispute settlement, IP, and agriculture. As such, she was involved in negotiations leading to the adoption of the Doha Ministerial Declaration on TRIPS and public health, and also represented Barbados in a recent WTO sugar dispute. Next to her, we have Lawrence L. Lee, who is an associate professor of law at Ming Chuan University in Taipei, Taiwan. Lawrence was born in Taiwan, where he received his LLB degree. He also, we are lucky enough to be also alumni of Washington College of Law, where he got an LLM, one of his LLMs, in 1996. And he also received an SJD from Wisconsin Law School. He is currently at, he was given a research fellowship by the Center for Chinese Legal Studies at Columbia University from 1998 to 2000. He was also a visiting scholar at New York University Law School in 2001 and a visiting professor at Central Financial and Economic University in China. He has also been a commissioner of Taiwan Corporate Governance Association. It's our pleasure to have also Lawrence here as and also an alumni liaison. Finally, I want to also introduce our final panelist, Ricardo Ramirez, who is also an LLM alumni from 94. He currently heads the international trade practice of Thatcher Profit in Mexico. He has for over 11 years. He was the Deputy General Counsel for Trade Negotiations at the Ministry of Economy in Mexico. He has advised on all trade agreements signed by Mexico and served as legal counsel in many proceedings under the WTO DSU. He's a member of the WTO Indicative List of Panelists. He has also been panelist on the trade agreement between Mercosur and Colombia, Ecuador, Venezuela, the trade agreement between Mercosur and Bolivia, and the free trade agreement between Costa Rica and Chile. He has been named by a Latin lawyer among the top trade lawyer in Latin America. It's really, we are very proud to have them all here, and especially as alumni of this school. As many of you are familiar, when there's much discussion has been going on since the WTO came into existence about the mandate of the WTO, and I don't think anybody but Jim was probably the best person to talk about this, and he probably will. But what has intrigued us who have been watching WTO jurisprudence over the years has been, what is the mandate of the WTO? I mean, the GATT was easy. We looked at it. We sort of looked at market access, non-discrimination, end of the story. When they actually amended the preamble to the WTO and added the language of, increasing the world's, investing in the world's resources, but only to the extent that it is consistent with the principles of sustainable development, what did that mean? Did that actually, is there another agenda there for the WTO? What is the scope and mandate of the WTO besides the fact that, what is meant by sustainable development? Also, what is meant by development? As we were told at lunch, it no longer is, and I don't think it's our understanding, just growth. So let's, without further ado, I would like to ask Jim to come and make his comments and then opening up for questions and answers. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor. Can all of you hear me?
Yeah.
I was raised a Southern Baptist many years ago, and in the Baptist churches in the South, everyone sits in the back pews, especially the worst sinners. I see we have only one man here who is pure. Let me apologize for the fact that I'm going to have to leave you after I finish speaking. Ricardo has promised to correct all of the incorrect things I'm about to say. I am a practicing lawyer nowadays, and I've been summoned to a meeting with one of my clients, but I'll stay as long as I can. In the brief time I have, I perhaps can be more provocative than definitive about the issue before us, so let me try to do just that. The question that has been posed to this panel is the WTO a development institution? Is it a development organization? My answer to that question, as you might expect from someone who once served in the Congress of the United States, is yes and no. It is yes and it is also no. I'll try to explain what I mean by that, but I think before I can, I need to address a couple of preliminary questions. One of them she has just asked, and that is, what is development? Evidently, your speaker at lunch had something to say about that. If indeed he said that development is not simply, not solely economic growth, then I agree with him. To me, development is more broadly the development of the capacity of each individual to fulfill his or her own potential as a human being. It is an opportunity to do just that, that I think is what development must be and should be in the eyes of those who are trying to define development worldwide. This is a broad view, but I think it's at the heart of much of what we've been trying to build as international law. It's certainly at the heart of the United Nations Declaration on Human Rights, which speaks in broad terms of human rights, and which has been agreed by every single member country of the WTO. I cannot believe that they would believe one thing for purposes of their membership in the United Nations and yet another for their purposes of their membership in the World Trade Organization, whatever kind of organization it might be. So I would say that that is development. And it extends far beyond economic growth, far beyond trade, and to individual human rights and a real opportunity to give those rights reality in the real world. That is perhaps not the answer that Ralph Nader would have expected me to give, but it is my view. Where do we seek development? Do we seek it in developing countries, as we call them, a term not defined in the WTO treaty? Do we seek it only in the parts of developing countries that are not yet developed? Or do we seek it everywhere? My view is that development must be sought everywhere. Development must be sought for all of the 6 billion human beings who live on this shrinking planet. And that includes Americans, I might add. There are people not far from here who are in need of development. We just call it by different names here in our domestic debates in the United States. It's vital, I think, for Americans to understand that there are 3% of the people in the world who are Americans, and that this implies that there are 97% of the people in the world who are not. I think we Americans sometimes tend to forget that. But I think it's important for all of us to understand that Americans must believe that trade and the trading system are worthwhile to them. If we're going to be able to do all the things we need to do worldwide to improve the trading system for everyone. This is the challenge we face in the political debate on trade and trying to go forward. So I would answer my question, where do we need development, with this answer: here, there, everywhere. What about the WTO? What is it intended to do? Before we can answer that question, I think we need to ask ourselves, what is the WTO? Because it is a unique kind of organization. And it is unlike the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund in some important ways. Those organizations have been given by treaty the authority to act of their own initiative in some respects, always subject to the sovereign countries that rightly control them. The WTO is something different. The World Trade Organization is nothing more nor less than all of the members of the WTO acting together as something they have chosen to call the WTO. Now, it's convenient in political speech making domestically in every country in the world to pretend that the WTO is something else, that it is somehow something other than that. But political expediency is not the same thing as truth. And the truth is that the WTO is just the members of the WTO, just the countries themselves, working together in accordance with a treaty they have written. Yes, there are a few hundred people who work in Geneva at something called the WTO Secretariat. But other than the secretaries and the translators and the administrative folks and the technical folks, there are a few dozen lawyers and economists, and they have the power to do nothing. Absolutely nothing, unless it is authorized by the members of the WTO themselves. This is why, for example, the appellate body is a quasi-judicial institution, because even the decisions of the appellate body are subject to ultimate approval, albeit by the reverse consensus rule, of the members of the WTO sitting as a dispute settlement body. Trade, I would say, is absolutely indispensable to development in the sense in which I just defined it. But here I might shock trade purists by saying that trade is a means to an end, and trade is not enough. If we hope to have development in the world without trade, we're foolish. We're short-sighted and we're wrong. But if we hope to have development in the world only by increasing trade, we're equally wrong. I think the best thing that could be done today, tomorrow, the next day, to diminish global poverty and improve the well-being of people throughout the world and enhance their human development would be to lower the remaining barriers to trade in the world, and especially those in agriculture. That would be the subject for another whole speech. But merely by doing that, we do not guarantee that there will be human development. The growth that is occasioned by increase in trade, the increased growth that comes by lowering trade barriers, is not a guarantee of enhanced human development. It's only an opportunity for development to occur. I would say it's a necessary prerequisite, but it is only an opportunity. What matters is what we then do domestically within our individual sovereign countries to try to increase the possibility that our individual citizens can take full advantage of the opportunity that more trade offers. What do I mean by that? Would you pass me the water?
Please? Is this your water?
It's the second one. What do I mean by that? I would encourage you all to read a brief article written by Jeffrey Hammer and some of his colleagues at the World Bank and published last year about some of the human infrastructure in developing countries that does not fully support the possibility of human development. They did a study of half a dozen developing countries in different parts of the world. Their study was focused on what really happens in primary education and in basic health care at what we Americans would call the grassroots level. And they discovered this. They discovered that on average, 19% of the primary school teachers in those countries do not show up for school every day. And they discovered that on average, every day, 35% of the health workers in the health care clinics in those countries do not show up for work. Now, if you have the economic growth potential that is generated by a lowering of trade barriers and a consequent increase in trade, how are you possibly going to make it possible for ordinary people to benefit from that if the teachers don't even show up for school and if the healthcare workers don't even show up at the clinic? So unlike many trade purists, I would say that trade is only one of the many things we need to do to achieve development. We need to do much more. And that's true not only in developing countries, it's true here in the United States, where a dozen years ago I tried to help President Clinton pass a health care reform bill so we could have universal health insurance. At that time, there were 35 million Americans who did not have health insurance. Today, a dozen years later, there are 45 million Americans without health insurance. I don't want to go on very long. I would like to be provocative enough to mention just one last issue, and that is inequality. I think a world in which we demand an equal result for everyone is a world in which there will be much blood, much terror, and much torture. And our experiences with Stalin and a few others would remind us of that. So that philosophically, I would say there must be some inequality of result in the world, in the workings of the economy and the workings of our societies. I would also say there is far too much inequality in the world nowadays. One of my concerns as an advocate for the trading system is that in a lot of developing countries especially, the people down there at the grassroots haven't had a chance to benefit from what trade ought to provide them in the way of new economic opportunities. It concerns me that among countries the inequality is widening. It concerns me that within this country inequality is growing. I think inequality can be justified only when it is a means to providing for improvement of the lot of those who are the least advantaged in any given society. This is not me, this is John Rawls, as I'm sure you all know. But at this point, I think we need to begin thinking much more clearly and much more emphatically about the inequality we see in the world and what we can do. I think Jack Kennedy said it best about trade many years ago, and that a rising tide lifts all boats. We need to make certain that trade does that, and we need to make certain that we do a lot of other things that can increase the rising tide. I'm going to stop there, and I'll take a question or two if you have them, and my apologies to my colleagues here. They are free to correct me after I leave. Does anyone have a question?
I would like to start off, if I may. Is it your from your comments, it seems to be the view that WTO itself cannot do much. It's really up to its members to take action. I mean, it's just an intergovernmental organization, and it, as an institution, cannot really doesn't have a development agenda.
I have a novel view. I believe that the World Trade Organization is a trade organization, and I believe that the WTO treaty is a trade agreement. Of course, the institution and the treaty have implications far beyond just trade, and by their very terms, this is so. And we sort out what this means on a case-by-case basis. I also believe that as a practical matter, you're absolutely right. There's not much that a few hundred people in Geneva can do to change some of what I describe in the world, nor do I believe they are charged with doing so. Even within the realm of trade, it's fine if you have rules on customs and import licensing and pre-shipment inspection and all these nice rules. But if a developing country doesn't even have a working customs office that is technically able to engage in international trade, it's hard to see how they can benefit from international trade. The WTO simply does not have the people power nor the financial resources to deal with these technical needs in especially developing countries. These needs must be met, but they have to be met in other ways.
If you have a question, can you just come up to the microphone?
Yes, yeah. Go ahead, young man.
Introduce yourself. And
thank you. My name is Hadi. I'm from Indonesia. I would like to ask about how can the WTO give contributions to the equality that you just mentioned before? If, like you said, that it's up to the members of the WTO, and you said that developing countries, a lot of developing countries cannot meet the requirements to get the benefits of the trade itself, that's will be can they can develop their own economy. So it's still WTO can do anything much to the equality itself in the trade realm, in international trade realm. So how is it should be?
Well, I don't think it's the role of the WTO to diminish inequality in the world. I think it's the role of the WTO to fulfill the purposes of the WTO treaty. And those purposes have been put into words, reduced to writing by all the members of the WTO, including your own country, as you well know. And they've all agreed on what it should be doing. And the, quote, WTO should not ever go beyond what the members themselves have agreed amongst themselves it should do. I do think inequality is a very big problem, and the growing inequality between and among nations and between and among people within nations is a very grave concern. But I don't think that the answer to that question is to empower the WTO or its minions to go around the world trying to reduce inequality. Now, I do believe that when you create more trade, When you lower barriers to trade and enhance the volume of trade, that creates the opportunity to diminish some of the inequalities on our planet in the ways in which people live and the opportunities they have. But we need more than that. We need more than that. Much of it has to be done at the national level where sovereign countries exist and where citizens can assert themselves in their own country to try to draw the right lines. Here in the United States, for example, I support a graduated personal income tax. Some people don't, but we have one. And I see that as useful. In your country, you need to make your own choice. More broadly, I think we need to achieve the Millennium Goals that have been established by all these same countries in their roles in the United Nations. And that involves action on a multilateral basis, far beyond the purview and the portfolio of the WTO. A very good question.
There's one question there, and then, yeah, please introduce yourself. We take two more, and then we'll go back to the panel. Yes.
I am Patrick Okata, and I am with the American University School of International Service. I was intrigued by your comments on the WTO itself as not really being, I mean, even though you say yes and no, it's more no than yes in this case. And then you cite the national government's responsibilities to bring in about development and so on. But if we are really going to achieve real trade and the benefits accruing to at least as many within the world as possible, don't you think that it is incumbent on, granted, you say nation states, under the WTO to begin to look at those inequities within the system that will actually prevent real free trade? I mean, the example of the failure right now within the Doha round is indicative of this point. Don't you think there
is
some level of obligation on the part of member states to actually empower the WTO to begin to do those things that will bring about some fairness and equity?
I think it's, I'll wait till you turn around again. I was with you until the last phrase. And here there's a misconception. When you say it's incumbent on the countries to empower the WTO, no, it's incumbent on the countries to empower themselves in their role as members of the WTO, working together as the WTO to do something about it. That's the only edit I would make in what you just said. I think it is imperative that we continue to lower barriers to trade and on a multilateral basis, and first through a successful conclusion of the Doha Development Round. And I am many times on record in saying that far and away the most important thing we can do there is reduce the distortions in agricultural trade worldwide through subsidies and through other means that inhibit growth and that prohibit developing countries from being able to employ their own comparative advantages in the world economy. So I strongly agree, and I have the political scars to prove it on that issue. But again, the WTO is nothing more nor less than the members of the WTO working together as something they have chosen to call the WTO. And they cannot escape responsibility for not doing what you suggest by saying, well, the WTO should do it. That's their tendency worldwide. But they're only condemning themselves when they say it hasn't been done. Yes, sir, this is the last question.
Yeah.
Mr. Box, my name is Hutsul Mata. I'm General Counsel for Interpol. My only relationship with trade is that I have been doing it until 1989 when I went into law enforcement. But accepting your view, and I think that you're right, the WTO is a specialized agency with a specialized function and should remain in its speciality. But even within that speciality, there are some elements, as you correctly said, sometimes it has some development function and sometimes not. And
yes,
when we look at those cases where the development aspect was at issue, And I know you cannot talk about the case you have decided, but we know the issue of the bananas litigation in the 90s and the discussions around the general system of preferences. Even in those cases, do you think, would you assess the role that WTO has played, particularly this dispute settlement mechanism, has it lived up to what it has supposed to do and what has been agreed upon with respect to those limited developmental functions of the WTO in Article 24 and Article 18 of the CAT?
The cases to which you refer are disputes that are brought into the WTO dispute settlement system by members of the WTO who are in dispute. And they're brought in there in order to clarify existing WTO rules. And that's their sole purpose. When one country brings a case against another in the WTO dispute settlement system, what they're saying is, this other country has obligations under the treaty. They have taken measures, laws, regulations, rules that do not comply with those obligations. So we are filing a complaint because we think they need to change their measures or pay an economic price for not doing so. That's what a case is all about. That's all it is. And there is no discretion among the judges in the dispute settlement process, the panelists at first instance or the appellate body at the end of the process, to say, we don't think this case should have been brought. That power doesn't exist. The Supreme Court of the United States has that discretionary power. The appellate body of the WTO does not. When a case is brought to them through a notice of appeal, they have to rule, and within 90 days. And they have to rule on the legal issues that are presented to them, not those that are not, and nor can they ignore some of the rules of the issues that are presented to them. So there, too, they're unlike the Supreme Court of the United States. If you pull the trigger in that system, you've got to get an answer. My job when I was in the appellate body was to give them a legal answer in that system. It wasn't to say, well, you know, I think probably the complaining party should not have brought this case. It's not really not a good idea. I may have thought that, but it wasn't my job to say that. I was, by the way, the presiding judge in the appeal in the bananas case. My job was to clarify, along with my colleagues, existing rules in dispute settlement. What we're missing right now in the WTO, and this will be my last point, is an effective means of improving the rules we have and adding to them and changing them through a negotiating process. What we have is the most effective dispute settlement system in the history of the world. It's also one that needs considerable improvement, a topic for another day. But what we're missing in the WTO is the ability of the members of the WTO to come together and get anything done in negotiations, as our friend over there pointed out. That needs to be done. And a lot of these issues that are unresolved, which may or may not relate to development, however you define it, are issues that need to be resolved by the member countries themselves in negotiations, and not, I would submit, in dispute settlement. Again, my apologies, and thank you all for your indulgence, and my fellow panelists, they are, as I said, absolutely free to point out the error of my way.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for joining us today. For any of you that have missed this, if you look at the Financial Times in the last week or so, there's a lot of discussion about the lawyers are taking over the trading regime, and that because of the failure of the negotiations, everything is now being litigated. And we were just talking about the exponential increase of investment arbitration or trade under bilateral treaties as well as the multilateral front. So then there was an editorial in the Washington in the Financial Times that started off with saying, well, maybe Shakespeare was right. We should kill all the lawyers. So there is definitely a move towards litigation, and I was surprised to hear a former appellate body chairman say that, you know, our scope is so limited. Nicole? Please, what we will do is have our speakers speak, and then we will open up for discussion. So. Okay.
Thank you, Professor Adai. It's really a pleasure and an honor to be back in WCL. I haven't been here in 10 years, but it really does bring back very, very, very fond memories for me, and I was saying to one of your colleagues that WCL was in part responsible for me ending up in the mission in Geneva, of Barbados in Geneva, so I definitely owe them a bit of a debt there. Just very quickly on Professor Adai's point about too many lawyers in the trading system, well, I guess I'm a lawyer, I might be biased, but I always used to complain when I was in the WTO that there weren't enough lawyers and there were too many economists, and they had no appreciation of legal rules, but I guess people might say I'm biased. In my presentation, basically what I wanted to do is, in a way, it complements very usefully Mr. Backus's presentation, because I want to pick up maybe in a way where he left off and look a little bit specifically at the content of the negotiations, because I was previously a negotiator in the WTO, and see what the negotiations tell us about the role of the WTO in relation to development. In that regard, I stress that obviously the comments that I make are my personal comments and not representative necessarily of the views of the Barbados government. And the starting point for the discussion in terms of the WTO and development obviously has to take account of the high prominence, the sort of unusually high prominence of the WTO as opposed, say, to the GATT in the context of today's world. And I came across a quotation from Pascal Lamy, the current Director General, and he put it in these terms. He said, in stark contrast to the tranquil and rather obscure GATT, the WTO has gained significant notoriety from world financial centers to small villages. And that's certainly the case. I can tell you from the amount of people that would be outside the WTO picketing every time we were having agriculture negotiations. Certainly there's a real sense in which, because of the expansion of the scope and the depth of the reach of the trading system, that the WTO has assumed an importance in terms of the debate in relation to development that is unprecedented, certainly in relation to what obtained in the context of the GATT. And we obviously have, in our, you know, in relation to that side of things, two camps where we have, on the one hand, those who would tend to be characterized as saying, basically, open your markets, free trade, you will develop. And on the other hand, I think perhaps more along the lines of what Mr. Backus was saying, and certainly I would be in that camp, to say, while trade might be an important element in the development puzzle, it certainly is not the only element, and it does not necessarily lead to development. There's something more that is needed before trade or free trade can translate into development. And so I reformulated the question which we were given in terms of, is the WTO a development organization, to say, well, can an organization such as the WTO, whose raison d'etre is trade liberalization, and some would say unbridled trade liberalization, actually deliver or deliver on development? And the short answer that I give to that question is no. But, and I say no because I don't consider it to be a development organization from that perspective, because certainly to my mind, development is far too complex a project for any one institution, and certainly one such as the WTO, to deliver on. Having said that, I strongly believe that the WTO can and should be much more supportive of development goals than is currently the case. And having said that, I recognize that this is not necessarily an easy task. I don't mean to suggest it, but I feel it is a very real challenge that the organization, including the members, have to come to grips with. If we are to really realize the development goals and all of these other very admirable goals that we've set ourselves more broadly in terms of the development agenda. Well, what then are some of the obstacles in the context of the WTO specifically in terms of perhaps, because I said, well, making the WTO more supportive of development and making it, empowering it to make a much more positive contribution in terms of development, and specifically the development of developing countries, although I take Mr. Backus's point that all countries should develop, but certainly we're taking it as a given that the developing countries are somewhat more vulnerable or are marginalized than the developed economies in this instance. But what then are some of the obstacles that we face in the organization in terms of making it more supportive to development overall, and from that point of view, being seen as more of a development organization, even though I think, like Mr. Backus, we have to accept that it is primarily a trade organization. Well, first and foremost, I'm sorry I missed the lunch presentation, but since we're all reading from the same, singing from the same hymn sheet, because the first major problem that we have, and I can tell you as a negotiator, is a real problem, well, former negotiator, is that nobody agrees on what development is. So, you know, we have 150 odd members in the WTO. We're supposedly all trying to achieve development goals, but or to achieve development, but we have fundamentally different understandings of what development is, should be, and how we can achieve it. And this is seen across the whole spectrum of the WTO membership, but it's particularly acute, ironically, in the context of developing countries. Why? Because you might think, well, you know, surely all developing countries want development, and surely all developing countries can agree. Well, no, actually, because the diversity of developing countries is such, or different circumstances and conditions are such, that how we approach those issues are very different. What a particular rule or discipline means for us in a development context, in terms of the WTO, varies very differently depending on where you're coming from. And agriculture is really an excellent illustration of this, because agriculture is perhaps the poster child for all that trade can do for developing countries. It's certainly one of the critical areas where developing countries have comparative advantage undeniably. And it is also an area in which the trade regime is often criticized for not basically following what it preaches in terms of liberalization and comparative advantage. Having said that, there's not a sense in which agricultural liberalization means the same things for all developing countries. Certainly, for example, say a country such as mine, which is Barbados, where we're a net food importing country with importing already about 80-90% of your food. Increased liberalization has certain implications in terms of rising food costs and impacts on your balance of payments in terms of your import bill and all of those things. In addition to which, there's also the broader debate from a development context of food security, rural development, and those sort of interlinked issues. And not to say that persons who want to liberalize don't have those concerns too, but they approach them in fundamentally different ways. And I remember when we were in the heat of battle in agriculture negotiations, and developing countries, for these purposes, primarily those of the mindset of, let us say, those within the African, Caribbean, and Pacific states, which would tend to have a somewhat more defensive rather than offensive position in terms of agriculture, we were in the heat of battle, and we were making some argument in relation to development, because of course there is a specific special and differential treatment mandate in relation to agriculture and food security, etc. And one of the ambassadors from one of our Latin American colleagues basically said the best special and differential treatment you could get is market access, full stop. And I just thought that was such a telling response. I mean, I understood totally why he was saying that, but it to me was so stark, was so telling a response in terms of illustrating the fundamentally different perspectives that we had in terms of something like special and differential treatment and what agriculture meant or should mean in the context of new rules on agriculture within the WTO. So that's one obstacle in terms of the diversity of the membership in terms of developing countries. But more broadly, the obstacle is that of a lack of real consensus or within the membership on what is development and what is required to achieve development in the context of the WTO. Another obstacle is, and this was one that was adverted to briefly by Mr. Bathurst, is the question of incoherence in international policy making. And he referenced the Millennium Development Goals and lots of these other important international initiatives and said, you know, and we have to assume for these purposes that the members who sit in the UN, you know, Barbados in the UN is no different from Barbados in the WTO, and one would assume to that extent, therefore, that there's some sort of consistency of approach and philosophy that you find within the membership of those two organizations. Unfortunately, while that's logical, I mean, certainly it's been my experience that that is not the case, and so for many countries. And so you tend to have a sort of, there's a bit of a disconnect between what happens within the broader international community in terms of development, so within the UN, within the FAO, within UNDP and these other critical international organizations on the one hand, and what we say as member states of those organizations, and then what we say when we come in the context of the WTO and making real changes to rules that will allow us to fulfill those purposes. And so I agree with Mr. Bacchus very much that to the extent that we speak of a failure of the WTO to contribute to development, to the extent that we speak of the failure of the WTO as a development organization, we're actually speaking about the failure of the membership. And in this regard, it is very much similar to the situation of the UN, which, you know, is always demonized and criticized heavily. But at the end of the day, the United Nations is no more than the sum of its parts, which is its members. It's, you know, it really can't do too much more than what its members allows it to do. A third obstacle that we face in terms of development and being effective in that regard within the WTO is the difficulty of that one faces in the context now of dealing with developed countries, because we accept in principle on the face of it that trade is an important contributor to development overall, but particularly to economic growth, that it has a real potential to raise all boats within the developing world in particular. But what we have found is that in the past and continuing today, there tends to be reluctance on the part of developed countries. You heard Mr. Bacchus speak of bearing the political scars of arguing strongly for liberalization in agriculture, for example. There's a strong reluctance when it comes to actually biting the bullet and making, in the developed world, and making some of those, and I don't want to underestimate or emphasize the pain that will be involved in terms of making these changes. I totally appreciate that, but nonetheless, they're necessary changes if it is that developed countries are to be able to be fully integrated into the trading system and to really share in the benefits thereof. And in this regard, I want to highlight some comments that were made by Professor Donald McCrae in an article that he wrote in the Journal of International Economic Law, commenting on the recent Sutherland report, the report of the consultative board that was appointed by the Director General Supachai on the future of the WTO. And he said this: China's protocol of accession raises a fundamental question about trade and development. How far is the developed world prepared to go in extending the benefits of the WTO disciplines to developing countries? And he answers the question by pointing to the terms of China's protocol of accession, as well as the surrounding circumstances of the dispute that followed thereafter in terms of textiles between China, the EC, and the US. And he says basically the answer would have to be that they're not very willing at all. So that gives you a sense of the complexity and difficulty of trying to really make the WTO an organization that is much more supportive and oriented in terms of development as opposed to just purely thinking in terms of mercantilist terms of trade liberalization. All right, just very quickly to turn now, having set that context, let us look at the specifics of the negotiations, the actual rules that we are attempting to craft within the WTO, and see what we can maybe derive from these in terms of possible changes or hope for the future, or not, as the case may be. Well, obviously, we start off with the Doha Ministerial Declaration in 2001, which oftentimes is referred to as the Doha Development Agenda. It's not actually called that. That was spin that came out of the General Council meeting. It's called the Doha Work Program. But somebody made a comment in the meeting about, oh, wouldn't it be great if we integrated development into our trade negotiations more fully, et cetera. And so everybody said, yeah, that's a really good idea. And, you know, all of a sudden, we started walking around calling it the Doha Development Agenda with no real critical thought about whether, beyond the words, whether the substance of what was being agreed actually gave us any real hope that Doha was in fact going to be a development agenda. And I highlight that to say that oftentimes the word development is thrown around and is used as a rhetorical device. And one has to be very careful in throwing around that term, that one looks critically at what one is attempting to achieve and make sure that, in fact, when we're talking about something as a development round or a development agenda, that, in fact, what we are agreeing concretely, substantively, does deliver that thereon. Doha, generally, nonetheless, did mark a significant milestone in terms of moving the organization forward. We had ambitious mandates in terms of agriculture, for example. We had useful language in terms of special and differential treatment. We had a whole separate negotiation that was supposed to go on in terms of special and differential treatment to make it more operational, effective, meaningful for developing countries. We had a whole separate decision that was agreed to in terms of implementation concerns of developing countries, addressing the problems that they faced in terms of implementing the obligations coming out of Uruguay. So overall, actually, Doha did at least hold the promise of delivering on development in some sense. However, 6 years down the road, as we look back, what is the situation? Well, we know that the implementation and special and differential treatment decision negotiations just basically became totally deadlocked and ultimately petered out. They were overtaken by the more current, the true negotiations, which were the negotiations in terms of market access. I mean, in the scheme of things, as if you have 20 things on your agenda, you have to prioritize. And as the deadline came closer and closer for the ministerial in Cancun, people had to make decisions, choices, and you clearly decide, well, okay, it's better for me to focus on managing the fallout from market access in agriculture, market access in non-agricultural market products, etc., rather than spending time in a deadlocked negotiation that doesn't really hold much hope of changing things fundamentally in the long run. So coming out of Doha then, we ended up, the hope was that we would have had modalities very shortly thereafter that would have allowed us to agree in a very concrete, specific way on specific rules that would have changed the organization. We now know that that was not possible because of the fundamental differences of opinion as between member states. And we therefore had what is called the July Framework Agreement of 2004, which was seen as an interim step to agreeing full modalities in the area of the respective negotiations. And for these purposes, we narrowed down the Doha agenda from the whole range of issues that were covered there down to what was seen as a much more manageable set of issues, namely, primarily for these purposes, agriculture and agriculture services and non-agricultural market access. The problem with the July Framework Agreement, however, from a development perspective, is that once again, we're haunted by these differing opinions in terms of development and what we need to achieve within the organization. And so the problem that continues to haunt us and continues to haunt the membership even now is how to strike a balance between ambition on the one hand and flexibility on the other. There are those who feel strongly that ambition, i.e. a high level of liberalization over a very short period of time, is the way to secure development in the context of the World Trade Organization. There are others, which Barbados would be among those, but it's not just Barbados, within the wider ACP, et cetera, who feel strongly that it's important to counter that ambition with some level of flexibility to allow for those who maybe will not see so fully or immediately the benefits of that trade to manage the process in a way that would be supportive of their overall development. And for these purposes, I just want to highlight, time doesn't allow me to go through all the different negotiations, but just let me highlight some of the elements of the July Framework Agreement in terms of agriculture, because that was the area that I covered, that raised, once again, these sort of unanswerable issues, questions, so to speak, in terms of development in the context of the WTO. So we have in the context of the framework agreement, an agreement that tariff reduction will take place on the basis of a tiered formula. So we're going to divide up all the formulae, the whole range of tariffs that we have within the context of the WTO from zero, let's say, to 900, and we're going to divide that into bands, and within each band, we're going to cut by a certain amount. And the higher the cut, the higher the tariff, the higher the cut. Well, that raises fundamental problems for developing countries, broadly speaking, from a development perspective, insofar as the tariff is the principal tool that developing countries use, as opposed to developed countries, to provide some level of policy space for themselves in terms of their agricultural sector. And certainly, therefore, you will find that for the most part, it is developing countries who will have high tariffs. It is developing countries, therefore, who will undertake the substantial percentage of the reductions that would take place in the context of tariff reduction in agricultural tariffs. Having said that, we do have, on the other hand, the question of domestic supports and export subsidies, which are the other areas of agriculture, which is where the developed interests are more implicated. That is the interest of the EC in terms of export subsidies and the interest of the U.S. in terms of domestic support. But even there, although the July package does call for a high level of ambition and discipline in relation to how we're going to regulate what developed countries do in those areas, we see, in a way reflecting what happened in the Uruguay round, carve-outs. We see little bits of accommodations of the sensitivities of these developed countries. For example, in the context of the July package, we have under domestic support the possibility of the creation of what is called a new blue box. Well, the new blue box was put into the July Framework Agreement to accommodate the special and specific interests of the United States of America, following on from the Cotton decision that was handed down by the appellate body, where the appellate body found that the United States countercyclical payments are infringed the WTO's rules in relation to the Agreement on Agriculture and Subsidies and Countervailing Measures. So the U.S.'s response is within the context of, which is perfectly legitimate to do, in the context of the negotiations to say, well, let me create a carve-out. But I mentioned this to say that overall, therefore, the question still arises about the balance of the pain and the balance of the levels of obligations, and therefore the extent to which the WTO will be able to really promote development, particularly of developing countries, in the context of the ongoing trade negotiations. Just very quickly to conclude, I just wanted to highlight a few of the initiatives that have taken place in the context of the WTO, which might be useful for us to talk about a little bit more in the question and answer session. And this is first and foremost the initiative on TRIPS and public health. We know we have the Doha Declaration on TRIPS and public health. That has been an extremely significant achievement within the organization, and we definitely have to give credit to the organization in that regard. Having said that, however, I do believe that TRIPS and public health is perhaps uniquely one of those issues on which we genuinely had a developing country position. The entire developing country membership of the WTO, together with the NGO community, brought pressure to bear on the developed membership, and that resulted in the TRIPS and public health debate. I don't know that we can rely on the experiences of TRIPS and public health to give us much hope that we're going to be able to fundamentally change the organization in terms of the broader rules. Another one is the Aid for Trade initiative, which was started. It's not a WTO initiative, but the WTO is also playing its role in terms of creating technical assistance, building infrastructure within developing countries, etc. Once again, however, very important initiative, but we have to be careful not to overstate it in the sense that it's addressing one very limited aspect, and in some ways people would say perhaps the least important aspect of the development debate, which is at the level of creating the infrastructure. But it doesn't go into the fundamental issues of how the trade regime is supposed to interact with other regimes more broadly internationally and the implications for that for development. And the last one that I wanted to highlight was special products in the context of the agriculture negotiations. This is a specific special and differential treatment tool that has been included in terms of language within the negotiating mandate for agriculture. Special products are supposed to be products that are important for food security, rural development, and livelihood security, and it is supposed to be accepted that they will be treated differently. However, our experiences in the WTO to date have shown that really the attitude of the membership has not been at all constructive in terms of really allowing us to realize the full potential of those types of concepts. And I apologize for going way, way, way over my time, and I'm happy to take any questions or to go into any further details on the initiatives in particular if you're interested. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Nicole, for that incredibly thoughtful and detailed presentation. No, it was very, very useful. You covered so much, and we learned so much. Lawrence.
Professor Lai, it's my pleasure to join the International Legal Study Program 25th anniversary celebration. As I mentioned before, I was graduate in 1986. I'm glad I can have this opportunity to come back to my alma mater and also be a speaker in the subject relative to the WTO trade dispute settlement mechanism. And the presentation I would like to bring to you is entitled Legal Aspects of the WTO's Dispute, a Settlement Mechanism Applied to TAWS Trade Disputes Between China and Taiwan.
I like to use this.
In my presentation, there are three major subjects. They will be the first, the World Trade Organization, created in 1995 with a dispute settlement mechanism. The second, the operation of the WTO's dispute settlement mechanism, which is the WTO's most contribution to the world trade system. The third one, under political tension between Taiwan and China, a case of tower over import to Taiwan market has caused Taiwan to use the WTO dispute settlement mechanism to solve the trade dispute in June 26. I organize my presentation into seven part portion. From the introduction, the second repeat. Okay. So you can hear my voice?
We can hear him.
Okay. So the
no. It went off.
Thank you.
contact.
I can make a distance, okay. I can control it. So rapid growth of using alternative dispute resolution to settle international trade dispute. The third one, dispute settlement system, the WTO's most unique contribution to international trade. The fourth one, the operation of the WTO's dispute resolution body implementing dispute resolution between Taiwan and China under World Trade Organization dispute. It's automatically. The sixth one should go to, there's counted something wrong. I don't know why. Yeah, these.
You want to go to the next slide?
Yes. Just go to the next
selection
automatically. Yeah, I'll stay.
Okay. So since the problematic enforcement of a decision and inadequate promotion of the GATT policy object, the WTO dispute resolution is developing adjudication procedures and the prospect for improving the dispute resolution process through a number of structural change. I don't know why. So including further emphasis on formal procedures and strengthened enforcement mechanism. So in Uruguayan law 1994, a major new area concerning dispute settlement procedure is the understanding on rules and the procedures governing the settlement of dispute, which is vital for enforcing the WTO rule and for ensuring trade flowing smoothly. The new test of the DSU solves many, although not all of the issues that have blocked the GATT dispute settlement system. DSU established a unified dispute settlement system for all part of the GATT WTO system, including the new subject of service and intellectual property. The dispute settlement created in the WTO has become a major tool to resolve international trade dispute among the WTO members. So the WTO dispute settlement established incentive designed to confirm national interest more closely to the needs of the international community. From reviewing chronological development of the dispute settlement mechanism by international community, this presentation initially reviews the development of the ADR and compare the current mechanism of the WTO's dispute settlement system with the GATT. This presentation highlights operation of the dispute settlement mechanism of the WTO, the implication of the mechanism to trade dispute arising between China and Taiwan. As a legal litigation to the Association of Yinling County, my presentation also analyses a trade dispute case brought by Taiwan Tower Industry against China. Counterparty to the Ministry of Economic Affairs demonstrate the dilemma which applied the WTO's dispute resolution mechanism under the political tension between Taiwan and China. Further recommendation for implementing the DSU on trade disputes between Taiwan and China will be submitted subsequently to avoid unnecessary pitfalls. So now go to the second section, the rapid growth of using automatic dispute resolution to set the international trade dispute distribution. The dramatic growth of international trade transaction increased more application for alternative dispute resolution than the traditional formal court system to resolve the dispute arising over the past years. Dispute resolutions is highly acceptable as a means of ameliorating the excessive cost and the delays of the international litigation system. Moreover, dispute resolution for setting a dispute of international business transaction in private sector contributes efficiency and the economical solution in comparison to standard. The computer is very sensitive. Considering the dimension of the international business transaction requiring confidentiality, speed, less expensive, and the easy of enforcement impairs the adoption of a resolution trade dispute. Realize the importance of a reformed GATD dispute settlement. The decision of April 12, 1989. So on improving the GATD dispute settlement rule and procedure was the interim step towards the final agreement that would ultimately become a part of the Uruguayan round of negotiations that had begun 3 years early. The adoption of the procedures of the dispute resolution mechanism significs that the WTO would like to resolve a trade dispute among members with a efficiency settlement mechanism. The succession dispute settlement system.
That's why I don't use PowerPoint.
Yeah. I try to not use this work. Time. Dispute resolution procedure have become more formal and independent and benefited from increased legitimacy from the WTO. The ever-increasing demands of international trade on the system have made dispute resolution a continuing challenge for the international community. Without enforcement, the rule-based dispute resolution system of the WTO would be worthless. Legal standards improve perceptions of legitimacy under the DSU. Like most international organizations, the WTO suffer because direct enforcement of decision of DSB is difficult. So with the enforcement procedure, the WTO relies on the ability of enumerated criteria to greatly enhance the perceptions of legit massive of the WTO goes to the fourth one. The operation of the WTO's dispute resolution body, the concept of the organizing an institute to charge with dispute settlement into the WTO system is totally different from the GATT. Under the DSU, a single dispute settlement body administrates the dispute settlement process, which is responsible for the duty previously undertaken by the GATT's General Counsel and the myriad numbers of committees under the variety of specialized trade agreements. The DSB oversees dispute relating to the WTO agreement and the various agreements pertaining to trade in goods, service, and intellectual property. Since the WTO dispute settlement mechanism, which might finalize a trade ban or economic sentence to the WTO member breaching the WTO agreement, the WTO is no longer a paper tiger like its predecessors of the GATT. The fifth, implementing dispute resolution between Taiwan and China under the World Trade Organization dispute mechanism. It is no doubt each member of the WTO should obey the principle of the DSU. As the WTO member, Taiwan and China will further integration with the global economy. Further, since the WTO has a unique mechanism for resolving international trade dispute, the WTO is able to offer a channel for less confrontation arising from trade between Taiwan and China. Following the possibility trade dispute caused by increasing trade exchange between China and Taiwan, an effective, fair, and non-confrontational means of dispute settlement is essentially for the development of cross-trade, the success of the WTO and the national economies of the WTO member. So besides Asia-Pacific economic cooperation, the WTO is the second international trade organization to which both China and Taiwan are members, but the WTO is the most important in terms of facilitating the economic development of Taiwan and China and in creating a base for a peaceful resolution of their long-standing conflict. For Taiwan and China, WTO membership and the most favored national treatment will protect both economies from discriminatory trade practices and barriers by established other countries. The WTO membership allows Taiwan and China to establish trade relations and consult and hold discussion with other countries under the WTO framework. The WTO already provides both a forum to discuss multilateral trade affairs and the rules, as well as procedure for the settlement of trade disputes. Taiwan and China are able to cooperate in the upcoming round of WTO negotiation on issues such as market opening, anti-dumping, countervailing duties, even labor issue and competition policy. Further, Taiwan and China also have a negotiation channel to resolve disputes concerning bilateral trade agreement that might arise in cross-trade economic and trade exchange. Now, a case of a tower trade dispute between China and Taiwan. The tower trade dispute is the first anti-dumping enforcement by the Taiwan government against China, who has 14 anti-dumping cases against Taiwan exports to China. In 2006, Taiwan and China began their dialogue using World Trade Organization norms and platform. In terms of the appeals of the Association of Yingning County Tower Production Technology Development, On April 14, 2006, Taiwan Ministry of Economic Affairs, by utilizing products specific safeguard mechanism under China's accession protocol, conclude the final safeguard determination on tower import from China, proposing to impose additional tariffs at approximately 66% for the first year. On 29 May 2006, Taiwan Ministry of Finance also proposed to impose provisional anti-dumping tariffs ranging from 107.3% to 237.7% on tariffs imposed from China, effective June 1st, 2006. The legal grounds adopted by the Yunlin Tower producers is based on both GATT 1947 and the GATT 1994, contain a safeguard provision as a safe forward against a certain increase in importance as a result of the liberalization of trade. Those two safeguard provisions emphasize on legitimating trade practical consideration but and assurance for the WTO member against trade liberalization. Union term producers also apply Section 16 of the Protocol on the Accession of the People's Republic of China, the so-called WTO Plus requirements imposed in China. Based on, in terms of the Protocol 16, if no mutual satisfactory solution is reached through consultation, the WTO member affected is free to withdraw concession or to limit import to prevent or remedy such market disruption. This section also provides reasonable public notice and adequate opportunity for affected parties to submit their view are given. The requirement to apply the Protocol 16 is different from the standard of the WTO safeguard mechanism in at least four aspects. Instead of a serious injury by market disruption, the injury might be domestic industry, but also include domestic product producers. Also, they can use informal procedure request for consultation, not like the WTO required a formal procedure. And that means the Protocol 16 is a very rather lax subsequent procedure. For more detail about Taiwan versus China on the tower import, you can refer to my article, and they will show on the website of WCL after finish of the conference. Because of the Protocol 16 providing relaxed requirements to the WTO member, China is bitter and claims to have been singled out of a discriminatory treatment, while Chinese respondents vigorously protest the use of the product-specific safeguard investigation procedure as being discriminatory against China. Obviously, investigation demonstrated that Taiwan prevails Chinese importer of tower in terms of the standard of the WTO safe mechanism. Nevertheless, in order to prevent from potential trade war between China and Taiwan, on October 24, 2006, the MOEA decided to suspend the safeguard proceedings, relying on the anti-dumping measures to rectify the injury caused by the China's power import. Recently, development, however, confirmed that two sides might have their own ways of dealing with each other without involving the WTO, as neither party mentioned the safeguards and the anti-dumping activity at the WTO trade policy review of Taiwan in May 26. Now I'm going to the conclusion and the observation. The resolution of disputes under the GATT WTO has been achieved with a mechanism that provides a reasonable expectation of a just result, largely consistent with the goal of the WTO. Having both China and Taiwan as members of the WTO subjects to the same rule and dispute resolution procedures, and will reduce the chance that political tension between the two neighbors that could erupt into military conflict. Moreover, in the future, the accession to the WTO might enable China and Taiwan to further integrate with the world economic by lowering import barrier and increasing the transparency and the predictability of trade. Application of the WTO's trade dispute mechanism is not only a duty to enforce the WTO's member responsibility, but also legitimacy of trade dispute resolution between China and Taiwan. Eventually, enforcement of the decision made by the DSB referred to action to compare other WTO members' compliance with the WTO agreement. So under the DSU, the induction of Taiwan and China into the WTO will still market disciplines and create trade opportunities with other WTO members. So thank you for your attention. I would appreciate any comments you might have to my presentation later. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ricardo, we should have this up so the lights can be turned on. Can you turn on the lights, Carmen? I don't know where the... Go ahead.
Fifteen years ago, a Mexican lawyer recently graduated from law school, wanted to study in the U.S. He wanted to focus on international trade. The NAFTA was being negotiated, and no WTO existed at that time. But this lawyer thought that there was a chance of a promising area of law. Some people thought he was crazy. Some people thought that the NAFTA will never get approved, and there was not a chance that he could practice law. He could dedicate himself to criminal law or civil law. Finally, this lawyer got, NAFTA got approved. The WTO got signed as well. And this Mexican lawyer graduated thanks to Professor Bradlow, Berenson, Joel Paul, and others. After applying to 200 law firms and getting rejected by each of them, this Mexican lawyer got an opportunity to work in the Mexican Ministry of Trade. And finally, start practicing what he dreamt of, what he dreamed of. My presence here is the way this Mexican lawyer is trying to thank this law school for helping his dream come true. The first question will become, I will try to address this question of what WTO is a development organization, and I think some of my colleagues touch upon the first question, which is, what is development? I will try to touch on four subjects of that the WTO addresses, and maybe try to give you the other side of the picture. Agriculture. We just heard Professor Bakos and Nicole telling us that subsidies are bad. They are the devil. They distort trade. They're the worst thing that could happen to every country. We should eliminate all of them. Well, that may be true. Just tell that to 100 million Mexicans that eat tortilla and that get benefit from corn subsidies by the U.S. and that get cheap corn from the U.S. so we can already have everyone have nachos and whatever. Or also tell all those textile and cloth producers that the cotton subsidies, they should withdraw the cotton subsidies. They get benefit from them. They actually could produce cheap clothes thanks to those subsidies. So in terms of development, is that a clear answer? Well, we should reflect on that. Services. Everybody will tell you the importance of services, that the trading services is more than the trading goods. But we need to liberalize more trade. Now, the question becomes, what about, and that movement of capitals should be encouraged. What about the movement of people? What about the movement of persons? Are we addressing that? That's another issue that I leave to your reflection. I don't have answers, of course, of any of this. Dispute settlement. We just heard our colleague describe a case on dispute settlement. There are 350 cases initiated by the WTO, under the WTO dispute settlement system. Everybody will tell you that this is the state-of-the-art dispute settlement system, that there'd be more disputes in the WTO than in the International Court of Justice. That there have been more disputes in the WTO than in the International Court of Justice. Well, maybe we should reflect upon that. Almost every dispute have involved United States, Europe, Canada, Korea, Mexico, India, or Brazil. So, as far as I understand, there's only one dispute where a least developed country has been involved. So, is really the dispute settlement system working or being used? Next one, regional trade agreements. Everybody will tell you that they foster trade. They are good. At the end, they seem that the trade is operating. Now, the reflection here is, well, many countries rely all their trade on these regional trade agreements. Mexico, 90% of its trade has to do with related to one of the trade agreements Mexico signed. So 90% runs on regional trade agreement rules and not on WTO rules. Now, what would you think? Instead of putting attention to that, the WTO is taking the position that, well, I don't really want to know about this regional trade agreement, even though trade is really being done under trade agreements. The appellate body recently rejected an affirmative defense raised by Mexico, and it was based on a NAFTA provision. So it's not a clear answer. At the end, all of this has to be addressed by Doha. The expansion of the WTO mandate. One of the questions that was posed by Professor Adai was whether the WTO is expanding its mandate. I will have another question. Aren't international institutions want to expand their mandate to include trade matters? I think it's the other way around. I think other areas of international law want to expand their mandate to trade matters. Why? Because of the dispute settlement system. The first example was the NAFTA, which was the NAFTA environment and trade side agreements have a provision, dispute settlement provisions, which at the end permits the country, the winning country, the complaining country, to put trade sanctions for an environmental or a labor matter. So that was the first example. But we have two readings here. On one side, we have the WTO telling no to labor issues and say, labor is on one side, WTO is on the other. We don't want to touch it. Recently, we signed, or many countries signed, a United Nations Convention on Cultural Goods. What does that provision say? Well, one of the provisions of that convention says that a country can take trade sanctions against another one for in order to protect its cultural goods. And what is a cultural good? In accordance with that convention, you could say that a hamburger is a cultural good for the United States, or beef is a cultural good for Argentina, and of course tortilla will be a cultural good for Mexico. So where do you draw the line? Or where do you say, or where do all organization, or where the WTO relates to this all these international bodies, international instruments that deal with international law. The problem is that all the negotiators at that time purposely or unpurposely did not include a conflict of law clause. So you will read those conventions and you will not have a conflict of law clause which will tell you what prevails, the cultural goods or the trade convention or the WTO rules. And if you go to the Vienna Convention, I think the Vienna Convention does not serve you a lot. So what do you do? How do you manage? And how do you manage all this, the relationship of developing organizations dealing with the WTO? At the end, that's my final thought, at the end it's a matter of balance. Where you do draw the balance between all these WTO these responsibilities, and where you draw the balance of the legitimate interest of an environmental convention, of a cultural convention, or any other labor convention, where do you draw the line? Where do you think what is more important? Where do you find out that a country is not taking a unnecessary or a fictitious barrier to trade and is using only the cultural argument or the environmental argument not to allow trade? That deals with development at the end. So where's the answer? Is the WTO a developing organization? I leave you with my answer. I don't know. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We're sort of running out of time. So I wanted to just thank everybody for coming. I mean, it seemed like we had Jim Bacchus tell us it's not really a development organization because it doesn't have any power on its own, but development should be a mandate for the members, and they should try to move the WTO in that direction, but it's not a WTO's institution could not. Nicole went into great detail in telling us about exactly how much development has become, whether it's rhetorical or not, part of what the WTO is all about, and especially in the area of agriculture and the negotiations. An interesting issue that Lawrence raised is what the WTO is doing in terms of allowing countries who don't have any diplomatic relationship with each other to actually use the same rules to speak to each other. So I would say to Jim Bacchus, if he says there is no organization, it's just the members, really it's much more than that. I mean, the rules that have been created allow for a certain amount of interaction, and it's also interesting that interaction then leads to possibly China and Taiwan not wanting to show their problems in public and then coming to some forced resolution behind the scene, sort of not washing your dead dirty laundry in public, although they're forced to do that, and then that forces them to behave in a particular way. And then I really thank you, Ricardo, for your comments on whether this is, I mean, you're right. I think the world wants to use trade. Other areas that are not traditionally trade want to use the trade mechanism. I always say there's a schizophrenic relationship between the environmental groups and labor groups and the trading regime. They don't like it, but then they also want to use it. So the movement to expand the trade mandate to include all these areas is not from inside. I mean, I think Jim Baucus is the institution. He's thinking, we get the legitimacy of the WTO. He doesn't like those picket lines. We get it legitimate by saying it doesn't have any power. It really is a reflection of the members, and it's very limited, and it just reinterprets the agreements, but that's not the reality of what is happening out there, especially as there are all these groups that want to use trade. And as you said, there is no other organization that has such a successful dispute settlement mechanism. This is the one that's been more successful and has had more cases than, as repeatedly was said, that the International Court of Justice has had throughout its lifetime, in the short time that the WTO has been in our existence. I thank you all for your patience. I thank our panelists for coming all the way that they have been from Taiwan, Barbados, from Mexico. And stay tuned for the next panel.